Call a meeting to order. Good morning, everyone. You have one empty seat, but Commissioner Levy is here, I know, and I haven't seen Commissioner Young. So I need we'll call the meeting to order, and I need a motion and second to approve the minutes of the commission meeting of January 27th, 2017.
Second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? That motion carries. Thank you. We'll get Bill Wyatt's executive director report this morning.
Great. Thank you very much. Great to see everybody here. And for those of you who are new, although kind of looking out there, I don't see too many faces that I haven't seen before. The executive director's report is actually a formal part of the commission packet and mailed out in advance. And then I just take advantage of this opportunity to talk a little bit about the events of the last month, of which there have been many, not the least of which is that for the first time in the memory of any of the grizzled veterans of the port, we canceled our January meeting because of weather. Never happened before, and you would be interested to know, I suppose, that state law actually requires that you meet every month, and this is a law that goes back to the very early days of the port. And we did, in fact, have our meeting, albeit most of you participating by phone, but it was a good thing because we had some business to conduct. I would also mention that we're live streaming the commission meeting. This is something we've started to do recently, and we will have a sense about how many people participated in that. And on the back table, you'll find an evacuation map. In the event of an emergency, port staff will escort you, everybody in the room, through the doors, down the hall to stairwell one, and out to the gathering area next to the north parking lot, which is across the road from the central utility plant. And the photos that you see up here are our monthly safety champions. It's been a really good period for the port with respect to workplace safety. And I'd like now to call on Stan Waters, who is our, among other things, our safety leader, to give us our month's safety message.
Thanks, Bill. At the December commission meeting, if you remember, Vince updated you on some of our existing and upcoming capital projects. And so I thought today my safety message would center on the construction and project safety here at the port. And, you know, the construction and project industry is a very unique industry, and it poses a vast array of challenges and risks throughout our entire operations. Our construction and project sites are always evolving and changing and impacting all levels of port facilities, our tenants, and our customers. So here at the port, we look at project safety holistically, managing safety throughout the entire project life cycle, and we really begin that process in the early stages in the planning and design phases of our projects, where we identify potential safety risks at an early stage in the project's life, taking into account impacts to tenant operations and passenger access and egress issues during construction. Some of those risks are then further evaluated by our engineers through our prevention through design process. And this is a process that is a collaborative effort between engineering, our maintenance, and our safety departments, where they eliminate risks through a change in design or they minimize risks by taking into account the safety of our maintenance personnel, and they will design features in to make those risks less impactful. Once planning and design is completed, we then move to the construction phase, and our safety and construction departments then kind of take over the process. And that starts with a complete review of the safety plans and submittals of the contractor to ensure that the elements of their safety plans are comprehensive and site-specific before any construction begins. Then we hold a pre-construction meeting with the contractor where we address any safety concerns and risks. We identify them, discuss them, address them, and including potential safety issues associated with the traveling public. And then during construction, our safety professionals visit the job sites on a regular basis to ensure that safety standards and plans are enforced and met. They have regular meetings with the contractor to address safety concerns. They review all safety incidents and near misses with the contractor, and when appropriate, we would initiate a safety stand down where we halt all work when any imminent risk exists or identified risks justify a new contractor action plan. So our aim throughout the entire process is to ensure a safe environment for our contractors, our tenants, our customers, and our employees.
Great. Thank you, Stan.
Yep.
On January 25th, we closed on the sale of approximately $244 million of General Airport revenue bonds. This is a process that we go through periodically just to be sure that we have enough cash to undertake the various projects that we have going on here. It was really a terrific result for us. We had a rate slightly less than 4%, so we did better than some other larger airports. And for the $244 million that were available, we had $2.3 billion in orders for those bonds. So there's just tremendous interest, obviously, in double tax-free bonds, particularly if you live in a state with a 9.9% income tax. And so this obviously puts a little cash in the bank and allows us to continue on with the variety of projects that you all have obviously approved. One note of interest, we have the year-end stats for PDX, for the operation of PDX now, over 18 million passengers. You know, another way to think of that is a number that is equivalent to almost five times the population of the entire state of Oregon have run through this airport over the course of the last year. So it's a big note. We remain as an airport in what's called the large hub category. We're at the very bottom of the large hub category, but nevertheless, that by itself doesn't really mean anything except that you see yourself grouped with other fairly large airports around the country. And what we've seen so far is that the growth rate that we experienced last year is kind of continuing. So I would expect that as the economy in Oregon continues to be relatively strong, we're going to continue to see growth that is above that which we have forecast in prior years. And, of course, that puts all kinds of additional pressure on the terminal building itself, which was not really built to accommodate that volume, and that is what accounts for many of the projects that you're contending with presently. One kind of big deal in the terminal building, if you've flown out anytime recently and then returned, you've noted that we now have new exit ways out of the secure area into the non-secure area of the airport. These are automated doors. It all looks very simple, but of course it's incredibly complex to do because the doors have to function in a way that allow people to exit but also not return to the secure area of the airport. This, you know, like so many things, is a project that, but for the heightened level of airport security since the events of 9/11, we probably wouldn't be doing. And one reason that airports across the country are going to start doing this increasingly is that the TSA is trying very hard to get out of the business of supplying labor for the exit lanes. And you think, well, you know, how expensive can that be? Well, it can be really expensive, as it turns out, to the tune of several million dollars a year to manage the exit lanes. And now that function has essentially been automated, and it provides a heightened level of security. So I would just encourage you to go over and take a look. They work great. And as you exit the secure area of the airport, you now move into either the far north or far south end of the ticket lobby, where there is on the south side a Starbucks and on the north side Portland Roasting. And I think it's actually a far superior way to greet passengers now. And, you know, I was over there yesterday. It looked like it was working very, very well. A couple weeks ago, we experienced quite an event out here at the airport, as did many across the country, with protests related to the president's order banning travel by certain classes of people. And we had somewhere between 600 and 800 people in the terminal building who were not here to fly or as meeters and greeters. And process and policies at the airport were not really built for that kind of event. Everything turned out okay, but it was a bit chaotic, and it's been widely covered in the press. And I want to give a shout out to our safety and security operation. They did a terrific job. They managed a very difficult situation as effectively as I think you can without really knowing exactly how things are going to transpire. And I think we ended up in a better situation than a lot of airports, which is people had a chance to protest, to make their statements, and yet the airport remained operational, which is kind of that fine line that we end up having to get to. We did, as a result of this, adopt a new policy. Airports are not considered to be traditional public forums. They're not like the town square, but they are a limited public forum. And so we have historically here at PDX limited areas in which the expression of free speech are allowed. And you'll maybe, those of you who are a little older and remember this, this really began in airports during the days of the Hare Krishna, who would go around collecting money all over the place, and before there was really much in the way of airport security. So people could go through the checkpoints, and as limited as they were, and out into the concourses, and you know, that's evolved over time. If you go over there today, it's entirely possible that you will find representatives of the Seventh-day Adventist Church who often distribute literature. They do it from these indoor zones that we have used. It's been used by people doing union organizing for the TSA itself, and over the years, a variety of people. And that has been the focus and the limit of our regulation. We require permits. The permits are free. They're easily and readily available, and that will not change, which is not to say that everybody seeks a permit, but we try to encourage people to do that. For groups that are larger than 10, we've now created a space that will be on the upper outer roadway, so closer to the short-term parking garage. It can accommodate a large group of people, up to 1,000. And you think, gee, what if there are more than 1,000? It's going to be tough to assemble a group at the airport of greater than 1,000, just in terms of access, how you get here, whether it's light rail or parking. Of course, we encourage parking. It's kind of a revenue opportunity. But in any event, it's a substantial area, and there is a plan in place to manage this as effectively as we can. We do have mutual aid agreements with area law enforcement organizations, which came into effect here a couple of weeks ago. Portland Police, Multnomah County Sheriffs were very involved, and we can draw on resources as required because our existing resources in the terminal building are just not sufficient to manage a large crowd of that sort. I'll be honest, there was a period, a moment, I would say, during the Sunday event where there was a concern that some individuals might attempt to actually breach the checkpoint security at the D&E concourse. And maybe some of you have experienced this before, but if you haven't, here's what happens when the security is breached. TSA draws to a conclusion all checkpoint screening. They go into the concourse. They disembark any aircraft that is still connected to the gate and the door is still open, and require everybody to get off the plane, out of the concourse, into the non-secure area of the airport, and then be rescreened. We've had this happen occasionally, not that often, but typically it happens because someone, a passenger, is going through the checkpoint security. They have something that alarms in their bag, and they forget their bag, and they wander off, and they cannot be identified or found, in which case they grab their bag and take off, and there's the picture of whatever the device is on the screen, and no bag and no passenger. And so the concourse, they call it dumping the concourse. The concourse is dumped. Everybody is rescreened. And you can just imagine the chaos that that represents. So having a group protesting for any reason, breaching airport security, is not acceptable to us. And we will do everything we can to prevent that. And at the same time, recognize that the we're Americans. People have the right to protest. We're going to do everything we can to accommodate those rights and do so in a way that allows us to continue the operation of the airport. That's our objective. The Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals yesterday heard the appeals to the Washington ruling. And I would assume that today we will find out. I'm assuming that there is some expeditious resolution of this. And in the event that the Ninth Circuit finds in favor of the administration, I think we can expect that people will return to the airport, and we will do everything we can to be ready. If not, it goes to the Supreme Court, and we'll see what happens there, and there will be another moment where we'll have to be prepared. But just so you know, we're on this. We're going to do the best job that we can. I feel very good about the way that our team responded and reacted with virtually no notice, and really put together a very good plan, and we'll do what we can. And as I said, we have these two goals in mind: continue the safe operation of the airport, safe and secure operation of the airport, but also provide an opportunity for people who have these strongly held views to express them here at the airport or wherever else we function and operate. The Hillsborough Airport Master Plan begins on February 27th. Obviously, originally, we were going to be in Hillsborough in January, and we're snowed out. And we are, I think, planning another commission meeting in Hillsborough. We've had, I think since I've been here, we've had one in Hillsborough. It's a great opportunity. Washington County is a part of the jurisdiction of the port, so it's a nice thing to do, and we'll see if we can make that happen. We've had two of our last community visits as a part of the 125th anniversary celebration. We were in Tillamook. Thank you very much, Commissioner Pierce, for joining us. And it was a great turnout. Very thoughtful questions and comments. It was great fun. The next day we were in Astoria, my hometown, and we had a great turnout there at the Maritime Museum. Same thing. It was interesting to note, while we were in Astoria, there were 13 vessels anchored in the river waiting to get upriver, and that's a sign that every marine terminal on the Columbia River is... It's a working river. There is a lot going on out there. And if you fly out of here on a good day, you can see vessels tied up here locally. So it was a great experience. The legislature is obviously in session now. We have a few items of specific concern and many of general concern, but one of the bigger items obviously will be the consideration of a transportation package this session. I'm hopeful, although it's never a simple matter. Anytime you're asking elected officials to raise taxes, it's a challenge. And at the same time, we really have not had a large-scale general transportation package in years, and the evidence is all around us that a need exists to address that. Connect Oregon is in the governor's budget, and I think that there's a high likelihood we'll see additional appropriations there. Connect Oregon is a program that provides lottery resources, revenue, for non-highway projects, rivers, roads, rails, runways, and we have received money from Connect Oregon for all of those things, and we have several projects in. In order to support the levee borings, which are going on Marine Drive here on the levee for recertification of those levees, Marine Drive is going to be down to a single lane for a period of time. So just be aware of that. It's obviously very important for the airport. And then finally, I would just say one of the other things that was going to happen in the January meeting is that I was going to publicly announce my intention to retire from the port effective June 30. And so, you know, we adapted. We do that here at the port. And you will be considering at the end of the agenda today the process by which you will select the new executive director. I've got, I think, four meetings left, if all goes according to plan. So there will be plenty of time to reflect on that. But just to say that it's been, for me, a terrific run. You were my third set of commissioners, basically, since I've been here. And I know that none of you have been through this process of selecting a new executive director. It's probably the most important thing that you really do as commissioners, and I'm confident that you'll have a very able set of options and choices in front of you. And I will also commit to you that as I have to my leadership team, I'll be here till the last dog dies. We've got a lot on our plate right now, and you're going to hear a few of those items today. And the port is in good hands and will continue to be so. Thank you very much.
Well, I'm sure that we will have a much more formal occasion to thank you appropriately, Bill, for your years and years of service here. You've gotten old along with the rest of us, I guess. But thanks for that. I also want to say thank you to the staff, our security folks, who were on site during the protests that were well managed, I thought. And I think the new policy on behalf of the commission is a good policy. It's predictability that's important so that we can accommodate everybody with their First Amendment expressions and keep a safe and secure airport. So thanks for that. Other questions or comments on the executive director's report? Is there a motion and second to approve the report?
Second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. Thanks for that. Stan, you're going to talk to us about,
Jed Harvey.
But you're coming up anyhow, Stan. Thank you.
Good morning. And we're basically here to present the 2016 calendar year-end safety performance results, including our historical safety trends. And also, we'll just provide a very brief update on some of the current safety initiatives that are going on here at the port. Here with me today is Chad Harvey. He is the manager of safety and loss control here for the port, and he'll be giving the presentation. So go ahead, Chad.
Thank you, commissioners and Mr. Wyatt. The areas that we're going to cover today are the safety performance metrics, and that'll be through 2016. I'll talk about that historically as well, beyond just the 2016 period. Also, we'll talk about total incurred cost, and then I'll finish up with the current safety initiatives and what we're doing in the organization from a safety perspective. And so the numbers that I'll show today are for employee base, not just our contractors or tenants or the public themselves. So also, in addition to what Mr. Wyatt had said about the safety champions, we select these four safety champions every month, and the key part of our safety programs are people. And so we want to continue to drive that as part of our tenants and our safety management system, and recognizing the work. And it's beyond just the safety department. It's really our people that drive our safety program. And that's really the foundation that we want to move forward, as well as a top management commitment. So this first slide that I'll show today, you'll see incident frequency. So I'll talk about incident frequency and severity as we move forward. As you see here in 2015, we had 118 total incidences. So one of the things that we want to have accomplished is a robust level of reporting of incidences. And I know Stan had talked about that a few months ago. And this protects both the employee as well as the port to make sure that we have appropriate reporting and that we're doing our due diligence in that process. As you can see, comparative to 2016, we're lower in our total incident frequency. And as we move forward, I'll show what that does to the organization from a positive standpoint. The next slide that I'll show you is also a frequency number, and we also look at claims frequency. So of that number that I just showed from the previous slide, we look at claims frequency, and this is more of a severity measurement. This means that somebody went to the doctor typically. And so as you can see here, we're over half in the comparison to 2015, that we reduced that to in half. So we're really seeing some good trends moving forward. And I'll show you a historical perspective in one of the further slides that we have here. And moving right along, and that's this one here. So when you look at this trend line, you see that downward trend line. So this is what a safety manager likes to see, right? One, that trend line to be moving downward. And that, and you can see it's a more linear path that shows that we're continuing to embrace our culture, continue to create a safety culture. The main things I want to point out here, again, from a frequency and severity standpoint, is TRIR. What does that mean? Well, that's a frequency measurement of total recordable incident rate versus the DART, which is the days away restrictions and transfers, which is really a measurement, again, of severity of people that were either off work or in some type of light or modified duty status. And so we can measure that and compare it to OSHA. So this is data that we compare to OSHA. And as you see here in 2016, coming down to the lower right here, we ended up in 2016 of a TRIR, or incident rate, of 2.92, which is our best historical in almost that 20-year period. Again, our DART was 1.53, only beaten in 2014 was our DART rate. So those are really solid numbers that we like to see, and we're seeing that trend downward. So let's move on and look at that in comparison to our peers. So other port authorities, as we compare that, you'll see port-wide that we're 2.9 in our rate versus 7.1 for other port authorities. That's over half of what other port authorities' performance is. So those are really good numbers. And again, you look at the DART rate comparative to national average. And this is measured on a calendar basis. Again, that's over half of industry average. So when you look at, say, navigation, we saw, again, below average in our DART or our TRIR, and we had an unprecedented zero in our DART rate, which we're currently sitting on almost 500 days without a lost time in our navigation division. That's a very challenging environment, and those are numbers to be proud of. You see in red there, our marine area is a tick above our industry average. We're actively working with our safety committees as well as driving that down. I'll show you some additional numbers with marine that show some positive improvements in that area as well. But we are seeing an increase, and of course, aviation is performing very well in our administrative staff. Are there any questions to this point in regards to the graphics? Okay.
So would the dredge be under marine navigation?
Navigation, yeah. So here, as I was mentioning with marine, for instance, we're under half half of what we had seen in prior years in terms of our frequency. So In insurance, we talk about frequency and dictate severity typically. And so we want to really impact the prevention side, and reducing our frequency is that is going to in turn impact our severity. And I'm going to show how what that does for us here in a minute. Again, you see that navigation had only one recordable for the whole year for 2016. Again, that's a phenomenal performance for that division, considering the environment and the job tasks that we have before us in our dredging operation. Aviation, you can see, has had a dramatic decrease, as well. Admin has kind of stayed more static. So what does that do for us in terms of impacting our frequency? So this graphic is a moving target. This is our total incurred costs, and this represents paid and outstanding. So we're really talking about workers' compensation. And we are in a self-insured environment, so these are direct costs to the organization. And but you'll see here currently, when we prevent accidents, we reduce our frequency, we have lower dollars being spent. And that's the stewardship that we're after. First of all, we don't want anybody hurt, right? The human aspect, that's our number one foundation, but also that will follow in our cost management as well. And so these numbers are a snapshot. They're, again, paid and outstanding, which is a reserve amount, and they do develop over a period of time. So you'll see more looking back 3 or 4 years, these are more mature numbers than you'll see the last prior 2 years. And then finally, our current safety initiatives. Some of the areas that we're doing, certainly there's more than this, but this captures kind of the breadth of what we're doing currently. We restructured our safety committees. We have a robust level of safety committees throughout the organization that's really driven down to each of the department levels in the areas where the expertise is. We're in the process of updating all our policies and procedures. Again, that's a pretty big lift for us in making sure all of our safety policies and procedures are really in line with best practices. And then our safety management system. And I know Cindy talked about this maybe a year ago, but several months ago at least, of our safety management system. We're in the process of automating our corrective action planning so we can really discover those activities that we're doing and drive the solutions and those corrections as we find deficiencies within our organization to correction. And then we're going to be doing a senior leadership roundtable or workshop on safety. So as you probably are aware, safety is really important as it relates to top management commitment, as we've had the safety message that's on the front end, and what we're trying to do really to drive that in our culture and show that we really are walking what we talk, right, from a management level. So that's really key, and to have that round table so that we're all on the same page. And then we're updating our e-learning courses. A big issue that you'll see going forward is the FAA will be requiring what's called a safety management system certification. So once they adopt that, we have a 2-year window to be certified as an airport. And so the safety department will be working in conjunction with Vince's team and operations to ensure that we're moving forward in that certification. That'll be a big lift as well. And then in incident management, when we look at those incidents kind of in the rearview mirror, we want to learn from them. So we have a robust level of root cause analysis, near miss investigation. We've really put an effort forward to get the employees to tell us what are those near misses, what are the hazards that are out there, and to do a thorough root cause analysis so we can learn from that organization. And then the branding of our safety program. This is an initiative that we'll be working with HR and our government affairs departments, and then enhancements in our employee experience with safety values. So that's a good final statement in that really when we talk about safety, it's more than just compliance. It's about the heart of it and having that and the values. And so our people. And so we really want to instill that in our values and really have people want to do it as opposed to have to. And that's what really drives our numbers and continues to drive them down. So that concludes my presentation, and if there's any questions of the group, I'd be glad to answer them.
Any questions or comments?
Yeah, one. First of all, thank you very much for the report, very comprehensive. The historical trend line that you showed showed a downward trend, but lots of spikes and variations. Yeah. Is there seasonality associated with some of it? I'm just curious as to what might sort of drive that consistently over a long time.
Yeah, that's, can we, Steve, can we pull that up?
That one.
So yeah, there's a number of things that can occur here, and certainly I don't have a crystal ball, but you remember back in 2008, that's when the economy really fell, right? And the kind of the end of 2008. And sometimes, what's that?
Vaguely.
So that was a long time ago. So that could be, and I'm just speculating here, so could be a result of the economy. Certainly there's the impacts that drive that. So if there's pressures organizationally or from a national influence, that can impact it. Also, weather can impact it, obviously. So there's a number of factors that go into that, that can impact those and drive those numbers. And so that's why we're trying to stabilize that. And what really stabilizes those numbers from peaking like that is really when you have that safety culture and we have that commitment and we're managing it. So it's a journey that's never done. And so we're constantly learning, and so we're trying to balance those spikes out from happening.
Thank you.
You bet.
And maybe, Stan, you have to answer this question, but or either one of you, but we also had a program of healthy lifestyle. I don't know if that was in the safety department.
Our wellness program.
Yeah. Is that safety or is that HR?
That's mainly run through our human resources area.
Okay.
So we but wellness and safety do go together.
Right.
And
I remember that, definitely. And I remember those presentations. They were impressive, especially for people on the boats, and their exercise stretching routine had seemed to make an impact. On
that was a significant impact, I think, for navigation by having that every day be part of our routine. Yeah. It really lowered it. I would just add to what Chad said a minute ago on weather. I think it was maybe 2 years ago now, navigation had to dredge through the end of February. And typically we're off the river in mid-November-ish, early December, before we get the severe winter weather. But you can imagine many of you have been out to the dredge and floating on the Columbia River in the middle of winter with icy conditions, walking on pipe and things of that nature. It's a far more challenging and typically we would see a potential increase in incidents because of that.
Yeah. Thank you for the report, the update. It's well done. Thanks a lot. Keith, you're going to talk to us about the Troutdale development. Along with Joe. Good morning, Joe.
Morning.
Good morning. This, as Bill likes to say, these moments don't last long enough. This is a pretty big deal for the port. And so I'm going to summarize kind of what the agenda item is. This is a $20 million deal. It's for lots 6, 7, and 8. In Tripp, Troutdale Reynolds Industrial Park. This is a sale to Trammell Crow, who has created Troutdale Associates to ultimately build a large warehouse facility, logistics facility, and the tenant ultimately will be Amazon. The deal with Amazon will be announced more formally by Amazon later on. So we will really deal with just the purchase agreement between us and Troutdale Associates, which again is Trammell Crow. And so before I pass it over to Joe to describe the item, I think it is worth kind of pausing and thinking about where we're at with Trip, kind of how we got here. You know, it was 10 years ago now that we closed on the site. It feels like sometimes it feels like 20 years ago, sometimes it feels like yesterday. This has been a true learning for the port. It's the largest brownfield redevelopment that the state has ever taken on. We were able to, the low-hanging fruit, frankly, for TRIP was phase one. And, you know, I can remember almost like yesterday, Joe was up here with the FedEx ground deal for phase one. But this was back in 2009 or so, right around there, deep in the recession. They're now in full bloom out there. They're trending toward 1,000 jobs, and it's been really a great story. But I would say the much more difficult phase was phase two, and we actually launched phase two right after phase one, in roughly around 2010. We had this site was awarded the Phoenix Award, which is the national award for best brownfield redevelopment in the country by EPA. But the phase two project required a level of investment that was far beyond phase one, not only by the port, but we really had to leverage the work of our state partners, our federal partners. And I wanted to just introduce some of the people that have been so pivotal to that. So one of the, I'd say, kind of the secret sauce to our success here with the brownfield is that the local, state, federal agencies, both regulatory and funding, all kind of sat around the same table through the regional solutions process from the governor's office. So Bobby Lee heads up that group, and Bobby is here and should maybe wave. Thanks, Bobby. And I just want to, it's a great story for when public agencies working with the private sector get focused on, you know, a major brownfield redevelopment like this, you can really get a lot done. And so the phase two natural resources permit was one of the largest the state has ever done. The site constraints with wetlands, with contaminated groundwater and issues that we really inherited from the prior owner, we did knowingly, and they did a lot of cleanup. But we have known contaminants still on this site. We manage those contaminants. As long as that is well managed, you have kind of a cascading of liability protections to future owners. And that's the way that we transact here at TRIP. It's been a great learning. I think this particular deal with Amazon, while we are not able to get into the level of detail that they will get into when they formally announce the fulfillment center, we've done a lot of due diligence on this. This is really a game changer from the standpoint of economic investment, tax base, and jobs in East Multnomah County. So I'm going to also mention Steve Wells is here from Trammell Crow. Steve Sieber is here as well. You all, I told Steve he just needs to come to every meeting. It seems like we're doing a deal a month almost with those guys. But they have had a transcendent relationship with Amazon around the country on other deals, and we're able to land this one here in the Portland region. And then last but not least, the city of Troutdale has been a great partner, and I'm going to make sure I don't miss Chris Damjan from the city planning. He's the city planning director. Thanks, Chris. And I will meet you for the first time. Chris must be relatively new with the city of Troutdale. And again, you think about the relationship that has evolved over 10, 15 years between the port and the city of Troutdale and the rest of our stakeholders in East Multnomah County. It's just been a growing, positive, great collaboration that we've had with them. And again, that's why we're able to bring such an important deal. Last but not least, this guy to my right, he's the one that went on the fishing expedition to reel this big one in. And so kudos to Joe, the rest of the team that were involved in bringing this transaction forward. With that, Joe will present the agenda item.
Thank you. Thank you, Keith. Good morning. This agenda item requests approval to sell 73 acres of property in the Troutdale Reynolds Industrial Park to Troutdale Associates LLC for the development of a fulfillment center for Amazon.com. I'll describe the sale property, the buyer and the tenant and their proposed use, including presenting their conceptual site plans, present the sale terms, and then finally summarize the development plans. This is the Troutdale Reynolds Industrial Park, which I will refer to TRIP and its master plan. The sale property is shown. The large lot configuration was designed to accommodate significant business opportunities like the Amazon Fulfillment Center we are considering today. The sale property is shown here and includes TRIP lots 6, 7, and 8 and covers 73.72 acres with road frontage on both Swigert Way and Graham Road. The Troutdale Airport is to the south and FedEx Ground Regional Hub is to the north. As Keith noted, and actually worth repeating, the Ports Development Team has worked very hard to convert this former Reynolds Metal Superfund site to a shovel-ready industrial park and regional asset to attract investment and jobs. We could not accomplish this transformation to unlock the value of TRIP without the cooperation and partnership of the City of Troutdale, Business Oregon and the Regional Solutions Team, the Metro, Multnomah County, and other regional partners. This is an aerial photo from November of 2015 of sale property looking east in the early stages of our Phase 2 development. Construction activities were designed to address wetland fill and mitigation, site grading, as well as extending utilities and roads to service the property. The airport property is on the left, and the FedEx ground is on the right. This is a more recent photo from October of the sale property after our recent TRIP Phase 2 improvements. Visible are the wetland fill and mitigation on the western part of the site grading to final grade. The utility and road extensions, Swigert Way was extended all the way here to Graham Road, and then on Graham Road was repaved, and there's half street improvements. The Ports Development Team, with constant support from our legal team, managed the land use, design, permitting, and construction activities to bring TRIP Phase 2 to shovel-ready status and able to respond to market demand. The buyer is Troutdale Associates LLC. It's comprised of Trammell Crow Company as a developer and Clarion Partners as a financial partner. This is an experienced development team with development investments in other port business parks, including Rivergate, Portland International Center, Gresham Vista Business Park, and this includes projects like the Subaru Master Distribution Center that just opened in October. The buyer is prepared to design and construct a large build-to-suit facility for Amazon.com. The port executed an option agreement with Trammell Crow in July that included two 90-day option periods with option fees of $250,000 that are creditable to the purchase price upon closing. The tenant is Amazon.com with headquarters in Seattle, Washington. Amazon started as an online book distributor in 1994 and is now the leader in e-commerce and logistics industry. As of 2017, Amazon is a U.S. distribution network of over 214 facilities and 89 million square feet of industrial space. And globally, Amazon operates a total of 361 facilities and 138 million square feet of space. Amazon has the fifth highest aggregate value of publicly traded stock behind only Apple, Google, Microsoft, and Berkshire Hathaway. Amazon has experienced explosive growth with annual revenues exceeding $136 billion in 2016, and that represented a 27% increase from last year. Amazon has over 268,000 employees, and recently announced that it expects to create another 100,000 full-time jobs within the next 18 months. The for this Amazon facility at TRIP, and this is consistent with other Amazon fulfillment centers across the country, it will have a 855,000 square foot footprint with 41 foot high clear heights to accommodate three mezzanine levels. The total floor space for this facility is over 2 million square feet. The fulfillment center is equipped with state-of-the-art technology, high-speed conveyors, and Kiva robotic systems. It will have large parking for trucks, cars, and bicycles. It also requires good transportation access. Amazon desires to operate the new fulfillment center in fall of 2018. This is a site plan for the proposed Amazon Fulfillment Center at TRIP. It's to be named PDX9 AR Sort. The fulfillment center is estimated at $200 million investment. This is based on the cost of similar fulfillment centers in other markets. Amazon did not want to specify job estimates, but the fulfillment center is expected to initially employ over 1,000 employees. A similar fulfillment center that we visited in Kent, Washington, had over 2,400 employees at the peak time. The fulfillment center has separate access for trucks and cars off of Swigert Way. Trucks will enter, have separate entrance here, enter and proceed to the rear loading docks, and then exit out the west. Cars have multiple driveway access along Swigert Way. The parking includes capacity for 276 trucks, over 2,500 cars, and 185 bicycles. Trammel Crow is still evaluating traffic and potential mitigation at and near trip, and will likely include a new traffic signal at Swigert and Sundial Road right here, and other road improvements. All required road improvements will be constructed by the buyer. The sale terms are as follows. The buyer is Troutdale Associates, LLC. The sale property is Trip Lot 6, 7, and 8, covering 73.72 acres. The purchase price is $20,071,456. This is based on a fair market value of $6.25 per square foot. There's earnest money of $500,000. There's a continuing obligation agreement for the Reynolds Metals Superfund site, obligations and protections. There's also mutual indemnity limited to 10 years and $3 million. And also and an indemnity and release agreement if the buyer transfers the property to a port-approved transferee. There's a regionally significant industrial site cooperation agreement. The regionally significant industrial site program was established by Senate Bill 246 in 2013. The purpose of this program is to provide assistance to industrial sites with economic development potential and bring them to shovel-ready status and create jobs. TRIP was designated a regionally significant industrial site in May of 2016. The port may recover some of its TRIP development costs through reimbursement from income taxes of jobs generated at TRIP. The sale closing is expected this May 2017, and there are no brokers involved in this transaction. This is the Amazon Fulfillment Center development plan and schedule. The City of Troutdale supports this transaction and development as it represents significant investment, tax base, and job generation. The city has been a great partner and is cooperating on permitting and offering use of the Columbia Cascade Enterprise Zone for temporary tax abatement for the project. We have also worked with TriMet to expand bus route 81 to TRIP later this year to serve TRIP tenants such as FedEx Ground and Amazon. Amazon lease is 15 years with lease extensions. The key development activities are shown here. Design has been ongoing and will be completed in May. There's phase permitting for both grading and the building that will be completed by July. Site grading and utility construction will actually start this May and proceed through the fall in November. Then the piling and foundation system construction will occur starting in June and through October. And the building construction will start this summer in August and proceed through September of 2018. Inside the building, there will be significant material handling equipment and systems installation from October through September 18. The fulfillment center is expected to be operational by October of 2018. Port staff requests approval of the executive director's recommendation to sell 73.72 acres of property in the Troutdale Reynolds Industrial Park to Troutdale Associates, LLC. Are there any questions?
Are there any questions? Bob?
I was just curious. It sounds like you've done some analysis of the traffic issue with regards to the streets that are on the north and the south of the property, but I wondered what effect it would have on the interstate.
When we purchased the property, we did a full traffic analysis that was based on the full build out of TRIP and its effect not only on the infrastructure and the roads within TRIP, but also on the intersection.
The interchange.
And so as we get more information on specific users like the Amazon deal, we and in conjunction with Trammell Crow is evaluating traffic study based on the numbers of trips that they are generated as part of this, including future traffic that's generated for undeveloped lots. That includes the interchange. Now, in the past, we have actually worked with the state to improve the 84 interchange, and certainly there'll be a significant amount of traffic associated with this facility, but it is designed to handle the capacity that we expect. Now, if the traffic study requires any mitigation or improvements to handle the additional traffic, such as a new signal, new turn lanes, road expansions, that will be required as part of this project.
I would just say that when we acquired this property way back when, a decade ago, this was one of the big issues, was the interchange. I'll just say at that time, it was really one of the worst interchanges in the Oregon interstate system. And in part, that's because it was never completed. the federal government basically got out of the interstate construction business before that interchange was really made whole. And part of our pitch to the city of Troutdale at the time was, because we'd had a lot of interaction with them about whether this was a good idea and so on and so forth, is that by bringing this kind of development activity to the site, it would generate momentum for investments in traffic improvements all around, and it has done that. There have been considerable investments in improving the interchange, because that's really what you're talking about there is the access and egress to the interstate to and from this site. And so if you go out there today and you get off, you know, along that roadway, you're going to see significant improvements that have occurred and will continue to, because that's kind of how we choose and make choices about transportation improvements, is traffic congestion improvement. And we have a great relationship with ODOT and with the city of Troutdale itself. So I think you can expect to see even more improvements with respect to the interstate system there.
Yeah, I would just add that the state has invested, when it's all said and done, close to $30 million, most of that in and around trip. The largest of those projects was the interchange improvements that went on several years ago, one of the early OTIA programs that came out of the state legislature.
Other questions?
Congratulations. It's an amazing transaction, particularly for Brownfield redeveloped property. I had a question about the continuing obligation agreement. I assume at this point what you're doing there, or what our continuing obligation is, really monitoring and reporting. Do you have a sense of financial implication or the financial?
This is in relation to certainly the Reynolds Mental Superfund site, and there's a consent decree. The remedy is in place, and so the only thing that's ongoing is a groundwater treatment program, in which we have essentially working as a contractor for Alcoa do the groundwater monitoring, and so that was really part of the purchase of the property from Alcoa. As far as the continuing obligations, there's just certain restrictions of land use. You can't really use the groundwater. It's got to stay industrial. It's really allows this kind of use, but certainly we and future tenants, such as the buyer and their tenants, have to comply with the Reynolds Metals cleanup obligations. And so this is designed to protect them and to protect the public.
Okay, but the remediation plan itself has been completed at this point in compliance with the ROD.
Yes, so Alcoa did an extensive cleanup. Actually, they've spent I think close to $55 million on the cleanup, and they and to their credit, they did it with redevelopment and reuse in mind. And so that when we were working with them, they shared our vision of making this a productive piece of property again. And so they removed all the source areas in the soil. Certainly so that we could have it cleaned up to industrial cleanup standards, so that it could be reused and redeveloped for the type of development that we're seeing here today. So Alcoa is still the responsible party There's certain protections in the documents for future users, but we have to just behave in an environmentally sound way to support the cleanup plan.
Okay. And then one other question, just because I couldn't do the math quickly while I was sitting here. What's remaining? What's the remaining acreage that we would have?
So not a lot, actually. We have actually lot one is sold to FedEx Ground, and they have an option on lot three for future expansion of the hub. So the remaining lots in blue, which are shown as phase two lots, are available today. But however, saying that, we have a pending transaction we have an offer on lot 10 and on lot 9. We have been working for a long time with BPA to enhance their electrical distribution system, and so lots 11 and 12 are essentially in negotiation with BPA, and so really the only lots that we don't have something in the works are 4 and 5, and so that's just a little over 22 acres or so.
Not much, yeah. I think it's hard to see from this picture, but when you drive out there, you can see the power lines. It's a major convergence of energy infrastructure, largely because of the existence of the old Reynolds aluminum plant, and that made the original configuration of the development opportunities somewhat limited out there. And the open space designation you see there is, in fact, it's a lot of wetlands and open space, and that'll never be developed. So we're running out of land, you know.
Mike?
Just a quick question. What was the acquisition cost comparably when you bought it in a decade ago?
So when we purchased the property back in 2007, it was $17.5 million. But the development costs kind of dwarf the acquisition costs, since the amount of work that we've had to do to bring both phase one and phase two to a shovel ready status. So we're into it about $80 million today.
When it's all said and done, and you factor in a patient timeline.
Uh-huh.
CFO loves it when I say that. It gets into that $80 million just from the port's general fund. So that's why this is a great deal economic development-wise. It's an important deal for us from a financial standpoint to recover.
You know, the history, which is interesting, we sold our downtown headquarters building and basically took the money from the sale of that property to buy this, to buy the Troutdale Reynolds Industrial Park, and to make some initial investment in the infrastructure, which was required. Because at the time, it was not annexed into the city of Troutdale. And I think that's a really important part of this story, because Reynolds Aluminum in its day had flexed its political muscle to avoid having the property annexed into the city of Troutdale, and therefore avoiding city taxes. We agreed to annex the property, worked with the city of Troutdale, and did so. And I think this property, all told, is like about a third of the land mass of the entire city of Troutdale. It's an immense impact, and you can imagine the tax consequences. FedEx Ground and now Amazon, you're north of $500 million of brand new tax roll out there. And then we built this building and moved out here, sold that one, bought Troutdale Reynolds. And the idea was to use that as seed capital, essentially, which, you know, we're getting close to a point now where we'll be able to go out and hopefully find something else that's available and do the same thing all over again. Yeah.
On the discussions with BPA, is there an analysis or consideration given for the transmission capacity and easements to the future site if they were to develop a larger substation there? And how far back, I mean, are the easements adequate?
Well, the easements to and from Troutdale are established. And that's really one thing that makes expansion here advantageous to BPA. Now, this project goes all the way from Castle Rock through Troutdale all the way down to Wilsonville. And so there's some other easements along that alignment that are more in debate. But really what, at least that TRIP, that they have adequate easements to accommodate this project.
But outside TRIP, there are some issues then.
Certainly north, mm-hmm. north of the river, there are.
Lots of issues.
So one other observation here, having watched a number of these development projects, which demonstrates, I think, the port's ability to step into situations where private developers would not, could not have taken on this kind of project, and working with the local municipality and government representatives is a terrific story. And so congratulations to you guys for pulling this off in a way that creates jobs and benefits a very large community around the port. So
thanks.
With Thank that, is there a motion and second to approve the recommendation?
Second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? The motion carries. And thanks. That was a great presentation.
Thank you.
Can we do that again?
Looking for your next project.
Can I just take 1 minute? I want to recognize Steve Wells. I just want to say this. So I've been here almost 17 years now, and I can't remember how many deals we've done in that time with Trammell Crow. But in addition to having an organization like the Port take on a project like this, you know, we acquire the land, we do the permitting and all of that, but you got to have somebody at the other end who's making the deal. Just a week and a half or 2 weeks ago, we were out in Gresham cutting the ribbon on the Subaru import facility, which is immense. It's just huge. And of course, once again, Trammell Crow was our partner. And Steve got up and made a few remarks that I thought were apt, and that is that we're able to do this effectively in large part because of the trust that has been developed by the two of us, by our two organizations, because these are big. In this case, in Troutdale's case, it's unbelievably complex. The addition of Superfund, of groundwater pumping, of all of those things would make, I think, an ordinary developer pale at the prospect of moving forward. But the fact that we've done so many of these together is great. And it's not that we don't have our arguments. We do. All of that occurs at fairly close quarter, and in the end of the day, we end up with something great. So this is not the first deal that we've done with Trammell Crow, and it certainly won't be the last. And Cascade Station out there, you know, the connection to light rail, all because of this great relationship.
So thank you for that as well. So Stan, you're back up here.
The port secures professional services through a variety of contracting arrangements, including on-call contracts. And these on-call contracts before you today are flexible contract arrangements that allow the port to augment internal staff with temporary external personnel to support the fluctuating workforce demands associated with our port projects. On-call contracts are utilized on an individual task order basis, and while the individual task orders have an upper expenditure limit of $250,000, there's typically no total limit for the overall contract amount. So when expenditures under a task order-based contract are expected to exceed $500,000 per year, commission approval is requested to ensure contracting authority is obtained prior to contract award. Examples of other on-call contracts within engineering include architectural, crane, diving, geotechnical, naval architecture, roofing, survey, just to name a few. These four particular contracts before you today are for construction inspection and project support, which will be used to augment our existing staff in the areas of project management, project engineering, construction management, project controls, and construction inspection. Here today to present the item is Don Chestelson, one of our construction contract managers. So, Don.
Good morning.
Morning.
This agenda item, as it comes up here, there we go.
Request approval to award four separate contracts to firms providing construction inspection and project support service personnel on an as-needed basis. Our engineering construction groups are currently and have historically augmented our staff with temporary personnel via these types of contracts. Our workload consistently fluctuates both seasonally with the airfield and other weather-dependent work, and also it fluctuates by project size, an example being the large capital projects currently underway and anticipated in the near future. So employing permanent staff at the levels required to support these fluctuations is not practical, not only to mention costly, which is why we use these services, Although a large amount of our work is done right here at PDX, the engineering construction staff covers project at all port properties. In order to ensure that personnel with the right skills are available when needed, every 3 to 5 years, the port has awarded these types of contracts to firms that can provide the requested services. So here's a snapshot of the current support service contracts we now have, which we propose to replace with four new ones. So as you can see, we've augmented our staff with approximately $4 million of these services over the past 3 years, and we anticipate exceeding this amount over the next 5 years as we enter this new construction phase. I should also mention that these figures are primarily based on construction staff, but we've expanded the contracts on the new ones to also include engineering staff. Briefly, here's the request for proposal schedule. We developed the RFP and advertised in late 2016 and made our selection in January. And we're here today at Commission with hopes of having new contracts in place by March of 2017. So a little bit about the selection process. We had an evaluation team review and score the proposals based on these criteria: project team, qualifications, and small business program. Six firms responded to our RFP. Of the six firms that responded, four were selected. I'll mention one of these firms is 100% minority owned, and the other three showed aggressive programs to ensure that maximum opportunities were available, and as well as a history of doing so on other previous contracts. So how this works, once these contracts are in place, when a staff need arises, we request resumes from each of the four firms and make a selection on the person or persons that best meet our needs. As Stan mentioned, work will be performed under task orders not to exceed $250,000. We do anticipate that one or more of these contracts will exceed $500,000 in any given calendar year, which is why we are here before Commission at this time. Staff requests approval of the Executive Director's recommendation.
Questions? Comments?
Just a quick question. Thank you very much. Is this a strictly a financial issue, or does it include a potential expertise issue as well?
Both. The firms are selected on their qualifications. Is that your question? And
to give you an example, here at the port, you know, most of the projects we do are civil related, so we have a pretty good size civil engineering group within the engineering department. What we don't have are, and we have some electricals, we only have a very few mechanicals because we don't do a lot of that work or in our projects. And so in order to have that type of expertise, we have to augment. So it's that, and it wouldn't be cost effective. So from a financial standpoint, it wouldn't be cost effective to staff up a big mechanical engineering group that we might only use occasionally.
And
just as an example.
Reference is made also the seasonal nature of the right. work here. So we, and it's always a kind of a struggle that we have to figure out just exactly how much, what kind of staff level do we need over the course of a 12-month period? What makes sense? And then as the peaks arise, we contract out staffing for a lot of that activity. Otherwise, we'd be employing these people. I mean, this money is going to get spent one way or the other. It's either going to be our staff or we're going to contract for it. If we contract for it, it would be considerably more expensive because we'd been employing them for a 12-month, they'd be full-time employees. So
it's the combination.
So it's a combination, but getting to Bill's point, we do, on a regular basis, review this to determine, is it more cost-effective now for us to staff up? And so a couple years ago, we determined that we really needed another construction manager. And so instead of contracting for that, we went ahead and hired because we saw that that was a very supported position over the entire year. So
given our efforts internally now to HR, to track diversity hiring, did we do that follow-up? I mean, I know you said we have one minority contracting party and others have been active in the hiring of minorities, but do we actually track their success in placing minorities into these jobs?
Yes. Yes. We do have a goal in the contract, and then, of course, they've all shown that they are planning on exceeding that. So.
Yeah. Great. Okay. Is there any other questions or comments?
Just a quick comment. I appreciate the answer and applaud it and applaud the efforts. I would also encourage the port in working with contractors as often as you can to disaggregate the data. Because quite often it's looking at minorities as a combined entity without sort of breaking out. And it's not that you can fix the problem of unrepresentation of certain groups, but it can inform other things that you do, your internship programs. I mean, ways in which you can sort of say, not a great answer today, but we can be a part of an effort to help identify people who can look at this as a professional pathway. But I applaud your efforts.
Motion and second to approve the recommendation.
Second.
All those in favor?
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. Thanks very much. Vince, we're doing the PTIP presentation now, recommendation.
Good morning. We're here to request your adoption of the Port Transportation Improvement Plan, or the PTIP, which is our 20-year look at our transportation needs and priority projects. We were here last month and did a public hearing on this program, and we need your adoption plus that public hearing in order to meet our regulatory prerequisites for seeking grant funding for projects that are identified in the PTIP. So Phil is here to give you just a quick update on what we've been doing and how this works moving forward.
Thank you, Vince. Good morning.
Good morning.
This agenda item is for the request for approval of the 2017 Port Transportation Improvement Plan, or PTIP, and its submittal to Metro and ODOT for adoption into the Regional Transportation Plan and consideration in the federal, state, regional, and local transportation funding processes. Okay. Sorry about that. The PTIP is a compilation of projects anticipated to be needed to ensure good access to port facilities and properties within and beyond the region. While the port will be the funding source for some of these projects, other agencies and the private sector are also anticipated to be potential sources of funding. For that reason, we coordinate our needs with regional and state agencies, and these projects must receive annual public review and commission approval in order for any of the projects to be eligible for grant funding. This year's PTIP includes 91 projects, not just surface transportation projects such as road and rail, but also marine and aviation capital projects. The PTIP was made available on our public website for public review, and notice was provided to our stakeholders and the public at large beginning in late November. And a public hearing was held, as Vince mentioned, at the January Commission hearing. The projects in PTIP are derived from facility plans, the port capital plan, transportation studies and improvements identified to be needed in conjunction and required as part of property development. We then used the PTIP to inform the Project Portfolio Office and the Grant Management Team about grant funding priorities and also as input into the Regional Transportation Plan. We then seek funding from the most relevant sources for our priority projects. The grant funding we obtain satisfies a portion of that needed to meet industrial, marine, and aviation goals. This is a summary of some of our funding need categories. Our next steps after adoption of the PTIP would be to submit the PTIP projects to regional and local transportation plans and to work to seek funding for our priority projects. Therefore, we request Commission approval of the Executive Director's recommendation for approval and adoption of the 2017 Port Transportation Improvement Plan. That concludes the presentation, and I'm available for any questions. Thank you.
Questions or comments? I know there are lots of projects listed here as we go through them, and we will see them again as they get funded, correct?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. Any other questions, comments? Is there a motion and second for approval and recommendation? Move. All those in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Thank you. Motion carries.
Thank you.
See you in the future. Now we've got the contract amendment issue.
Yes, similar to one that we actually did last month. So we're requesting approval to award an amendment to the Taxiway B Center and Exits Rehab Project to place casings and conduits here at PDX. And last month, you all approved the design build contract for the parking and consolidated rental car facility project, which identified that a lot of several needs for utility relocations. The amendment today is in support of relocating the main Pacific Power and Light power feed for PDX and the primary south airfield lighting electrical line. So I'm going to have Chris Edwards present the recommendation for this amendment.
Thanks, Vince, and good morning.
Good morning.
So today I'm requesting approval toward a contract amendment to K&E Excavating for on the Taxiway B project in the amount of nearly $2 million. This shows the overall project location, which in essence is right outside that window. The work that's before you today is shown in yellow, and the work that was presented at the last commission meeting by Dave Dittmer is shown in the blue area as a change order to the QTA project. While beginning the development phase of the parking and consolidated rental car facility, or PACR, the team started looking at the overall utility plan associated with both of those projects. And it was discovered that the utilities for the PACR project needed to be relocated soon in order to avoid tearing out completed work associated with the QTA project in the future. Early relocations of utilities would also allow us to avoid significant operational impacts as well as safety issues. As you can see in the PACR footprint here, there are two lines located through it. The one on the left is the power line that Vince just mentioned with PP&L, and the other to the right is the airfield lighting. Those lines eventually need to be relocated in order to make way for that building. And once those relocations occur, those lines will be abandoned. Some of this rerouting work needs to occur on the airfield. And so we started looking at the Taxiway B project in order to complete that work for the following reasons. So we already have a contractor mobilized on site for that work. They are badged to work on the secure airfield. We have a subcontractor that is specialized in pipe jacking, which places pipe by mechanical means with a hydraulic jack. And I would specifically note this, the black lines that you see on the screen there, we have to pipe jack under taxiways, but I think one of the more important ones is the one on the far right here. We have to go under Airport Way as well as the TriMet Max tracks. So that specialized skill is very much important. And Also, by using the Taxiway B contractor, we would just have one contractor working on the site versus two, which allows us to plan and coordinate that work. In that way, it avoids operational impacts. And lastly, had we bid this work out, it would likely have cost us twice as much money. This shows the overall project schedule. The item bolded on the left is the commission action item before you today. This work will be done in combination with the Taxiway B work this summer. Here's the overall budget and funding. Here's the K&E contract that was awarded back in July of last year. We've had change orders to date, which were done under the executive director's delegated authority, and the contract amendment before you today, which will be paid for out of the Packer project, out of the Port Cost Center. Staff requests approval of the executive director's recommendation.
Any questions, comments? Thanks. Is there a motion and second to approve the amendment? All those in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. Thanks.
Thank you.
And the final item on the agenda, Bobby? And just, we have one person, Michael Hall, signed up to speak to this issue. What we'll do is we'll have Bobby's presentation, and then I'll give you a shout out. Thanks.
In preparation for Bill Wyatt's departure, Port staff, in partnership with Jim Carter, did an RFP for a search firm. And we have entered into an agreement with McDermott and Bull. They're an Irvine, California-based search firm. And I have here with me today is Craig Sabina, who is a principal consultant from McDermott and Bull.
Hello, everyone. Nice to meet you.
Good morning.
And I am before you today to seek approval for the job profile as well as the search process, otherwise referenced in your materials as hiring procedures, standards, criteria, and policy directives. On January 13th, we made a couple of press releases. One was announcing Bill's departure, and the other one was announcing that we had hired McDermott and Bull and would engage them in the search process. And as part of that announcement, we attached a link to the website to obtain public comments to help inform us on the creation of the job profile. And those comments are in your packet. We received 92 comments, and so staff looked at those comments and identified some common themes from those comments. Those common themes were to increase an emphasis on building strong relationships and partnerships with local communities and neighborhoods, environmental stewardship, a commitment to diversity, equity, and inclusion in the staffing of port facilities, as well as its operations, tenants, and interactions with its surrounding communities. And then also a desire for candidates to have an understanding of transportation, specifically multimodal transportation. So based on these themes, the port staff did modify the job profile. That modified job profile is in your packet, but I did want to highlight the changes that were made. So under the principal accountabilities and essential functions, we added to demonstrate an openness and transparency in partnering with various stakeholders. We added lead the port in safeguarding the port's safety, security, operations, and values in cooperation with our workforce and business partners. We added take a leadership role in ensuring the port is vigilant and innovative in addressing how its growing operations impact the environment. And then we modified embed diversity inclusion and added social equity with measurable outcomes into the port's business strategy. And then under essential functional requirements, we modified demonstrated skills in building strong relationships with the business, local communities, and neighborhoods and political stakeholders. We modify demonstrating skills in incorporating diversity, equity, and inclusion into business principles and practices. and we added a working knowledge of regional multimodal transportation. Any questions on that so far? Okay. So I'm moving to the timeline and the process, which is outlined for you here. So as of February now, where I'm asking you to adopt the criteria. In March, the prospective qualified candidates will be screened and presented to us. And then the executive search firm in end of March, early April likely, will present those candidates to the advisory group. And I'll explain the advisory group's role here in just a moment. Then the March-April timeframe, the in executive session, the advisory group will interview candidates and recommend finalists to the full commission. Then we'll have another public comment on the recommended finalists. So we assume that once the advisory group has narrowed the candidates down to some number, maybe two or three, could be more, that we would share those recommended finalists with the public, seek feedback or comments from the public or questions that they might ask the commission to consider as the commission moves into the interview process with those final candidates. Then in May and June, the executive sessions will occur where the full commission will interview the finalists and come to a tentative consensus on the selection of a candidate. Then by July commission, we would move to a vote for that that candidate. The role for the advisory group is to interview the candidates and recommend finalists to the commission. The advisory group will be made up of four port commissioners, Commissioner Levy, Commissioner Saruta, Commissioner Alexander, and
Commissioner McDonald.
Commissioner McDonald, thank you. And we will also have three to four external stakeholders. And those stakeholders, we don't have the full names of those stakeholders today to present to commission, but we will announce who the rest of those stakeholders are publicly when we have concluded that process.
I think, Bobby, one thing there that might be helpful is to clarify what it means to be in executive session.
Okay. So in executive session, that means that the public is not in the room, but press is allowed in the room. And if I will allow general counsel here to elaborate on that if you feel like we need more information.
I'd just say that it is publicly noticed just like any other commission meeting, or in this case, the advisory group. Because the advisory group is making a recommendation, a collective recommendation on finalists under public meetings laws, that group is considered a governing body subject to the public records laws. So all of the meetings of the advisory group will be publicly noticed. Again, as Bobby said, they will be closed to the general public, but the press has a right to be present. So there is an element of transparency for both the advisory group meetings and the commission meetings.
And the press, I think it's important to note, are not supposed to be reporting on the contents of the meeting, but there are no sanctions for that. So
correct.
Okay. Thanks.
Right. Yeah. So the staff requests approval of the commission president's recommendation on the hiring procedures, standards, criteria, and policy directives for the executive director search.
So, and before we take that under consideration, I'll open this as a public hearing, ask for comments, and Michael, this would be a good time for you to come forward. Thanks. And I'll be reminded, I'm sure, after you finish, if there are any other public comments to be made, that we'll take them at this time. So, good morning.
Hey, good morning. I think most of you know me. My name is Michael Hall. I'm an organizer with Unite Here, Local 8. And what I'm testifying about today is less about the executive director search, but I think it's something to keep in mind as you go forward and make this decision as a commission. So I work with about 180 concession workers here at the airport, including those in the Rogue and Roses outlets on the D concourse. So about 2 years ago, they came together to form a union to make changes to what were some pretty low standards at their jobs here at the airport. That's now at risk. You might know that there's an RFP that has recently gone out. It does include the spaces for Rogue and Roses. And we are disappointed the port has not come through to fix the issue of worker retention there. These workers fought to improve those jobs, and now those quality jobs could be disappearing. And this isn't the first time those workers have had to go through this process. Some of them did work at Gustav's on the C concourse, and they fought, won recognition of their union, and as soon as they began bargaining, Gustav's was kicked out of the airport, and they lost those jobs. You know, every time good jobs are at the port, workers have come together to make those changes. When they are kicked out of the airport, those gains go away. It creates a cycle of poverty here. This is unacceptable. You're the governing body of the airport, and we really hope that you can make a change and have a moral obligation put a stop to that cycle of poverty so that the gains that are made here by workers can stay here. Thank you.
Thank you for your comments. Questions or comments of Michael? Tom?
Michael, how many folks work at Rogue and Roses?
It's roughly 50 right now. There's a few positions that may move to another location, such as Starbucks Food Prep, but they are dependent on that kitchen right now.
Okay, thanks.
Any other questions, comments? Thanks for your comments. Yeah. We have heard you before, and we'll continue our efforts to make this a great place to work. So
yeah,
thanks.
Thank you for your time, everyone.
Any other public comments on the search? So I'll close the sorry.
Not public.
Or sorry, but
When will the community members to the advisory board be made known to us?
I'm expecting, and talked with the officers this morning, it'll be within a week that we'll have that group decided and made public.
Thank you. Yeah, relative to that, I have one more question. You said either four or five community
our
leaders.
Our announcement says three or four.
Okay. So that has not been decided yet. So what is the rationale behind whether it's three or four?
I think a good question, but I think the rationale is to keep from the beginning, it's been an effort to keep the group sized in total workable. There are four commissioners already part of it. And that group has a responsibility to effectively interview candidates and make a recommendation. Whether it's three or four really depends on the need to have a variety of experiences, qualifications, in that group, and whether that's met by three as opposed to four is just something that we're continuing to consider. So I'm going to close the public hearing, and is there any are there any questions or comments to Bobby from the commission? Okay. Is there a motion second to approve the recommendation?
So moved. Second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. Thanks for your work on that. And you too, Craig. It's good to see you here.
My pleasure. Thank you.
I think that is the full agenda, so I'll close the meeting.